a road trip up to San Francisco. Then they had to be subject to 15 minutes of stink eye from the board of directors, who saw two guys with no way of paying back their loan. It was quite obvious, Roy said, that the best thing we could do was keep our collective mouths shut. Then relief. The president arrived and was a fan of Disney films. They're good this year, they're good next year, and they're good the year after that, he boasted. Disney's crop of problems, weakened foreign markets, no ability to crank out cheapo domestic war pictures for quick profits, payments wallpapered throughout Europe, working for that cheapskate Uncle Sam, would all be fixed with the war's end. It was a risk to give Disney money, yes, but the bigger risk was not being prepared for normalcy once the damn war was over. The debt then grew to almost $4.5 million, which prompted another rough meeting. After being tongue-lashed, Walt announced with wounded pride that if that was how the bank felt, he and Roy might have to start borrowing money elsewhere. It was a perfect fourth panel gag, the logic of a drunk with a bar tab. Yet it was not meant as a joke. Walt was sincere. Rumors of secret weapons were an irresistible topic for wartime quidnuncs. Everyone hoped for a one-step solution to the war. A 1937 Mickey Mouse strip promised vast powers if the atom was harnessed. The strip's secret formula for atomic power had to be kept out of enemies' hands, but also allied hands, since its possession would spur a constant war. No one much cared about such mumbo-jumbo. Things were different now. A 1944 Private Snafu cartoon had the loose-lipped Snafu blab to his girlfriend about a secret weapon. Someone with top-secret clearance heard about the cartoon and kept it out of circulation, since a warning to not blab suggested there was something to blab about. On August 6, 1945, the world would find out the truth about secret weapons. As promised, it ended the war. And as Floyd predicted in 1937, it started a still ongoing conflict about who gets to hold such atomic power. Peacetime did not mean an immediate return to feature work at Disney. After the war was over, we were like a bear coming out of hibernation, Roy said. We were skinny and gaunt, and we had no fat on our bones. Those were lost years for us. The military commissions dried up, and there was nothing in the feature pipeline, so the stock prices were falling. Just as soldiers can have a hard time coming home, Disney had a hard time switching back to regular studio life. The investors wanted to announce a big expansion, which would raise share prices. Walt and Roy disagreed. This was no time to try something new. We're doing what we think we should do, Walt said, and that's to take care of the best interests of the company, not any individual stockholder. This comment doubled as a backhand to the employees who were dumping their company shares. The shares had become a wonderful metaphor to reward those who kept believing in him. Just keep swimming. I-O, it's off to work I go. In August 1945, Roy broke the glass in case of emergency and held an initial public offering of common stock. It was that or merge with RKO, which was also discussed. From then on, Walt had to convince more than just Roy to get a project off the ground. New President Harry Truman might have the buck stops here sign, but that wasn't on Walt's desk anymore. He had thousands of new bosses, and they all wanted seed corn eating short-term profits. In 1945, Disney also cranked out 10 non-military government films. They dealt with health topics for the Office of Inter-American Affairs. Hookworm, malaria, and tuberculosis. This was low-profit, low-prestige work, and it went against the Disney grain now that the war was over. What Disney needed was features, which were slowly creaking back into circulation. Making them pop was Ub Iwerks's new post-war gig. He was now head of special processes and animation. Nowadays, we would refer to it as special effects. If it could be done mechanically, chemically, or practically, Ub Iwerks would figure out a way to work the trick. With hope of a ceasefire, Walt began an animation partnership with Spain's Salvador Dali, for whom a giant mouse with foot-wide ears might appear rational. 1 year of collaborative work resulted in 17 seconds of film, At this rate of production, clocks really were melting. The film called Destino was eventually completed in 2003. Walt also started a collaboration with Aldous Huxley, sicking the famed writer on a live-action Alice in Wonderland. This version would star Ginger Rogers instead of Mary Pickford. When Huxley handed in his screenplay, Walt said he could understand only every third word of it. Neither the screenplay nor Ginger Rogers made it to the finished production. Alice was reimagined as a cartoon. A third collaborator was Gene Kelly, who wanted to dance on screen with Mickey Mouse in the Sailors on Leave film Anchors Away. That would be a perfect parallel to Donald's Veracruz Jitterbug, but that sort of work took time and money, and Disney had neither. Gene Kelly ended up filling his dance card with Jerry from Tom and Jerry. Huxley, Dolly, Gene Kelly, Ginger Rogers, even Ub Iwerks. Was there anyone Walt wasn't working with? Yes, the one who brung him. There were no new post-war Mickey Mouses in the works. Walt would occasionally spitball a Horatio Alger-style adventure, but the stories were never made. Donald and Goofy shorts continued. There was still an audience for quick-tempered and dim-witted fools, but there was no place for a buoyant little optimist in a world where 60 million people had just killed each other. For him, Walt said a few years later with relish, "It's definitely trap time." In a radio broadcast 3 years later, Walt said that Mickey was a chicken with no meat left on its bones. The psychoanalysts have probed him. Wise men of critical inclination have pondered him. Columnists have kidded him. Admirers have saluted him in extravagant terms. But all we ever intended for him and expected of him was that he should continue to make people everywhere chuckle with him and at him. Mickey was simply a little personality assigned to the purposes of laughter. Belts were too tight around the nation right now for belly laughs. One of Disney's post-war sacrifices was feature work. What was needed in 1945 was work that could be finished in 1945, not 1950. Work suspended on Alice, Peter Pan, and a dog movie eventually called Lady and the Tramp. One Mickey that had kicked around 4 years half-finished, Mickey and the Beanstalk, finally got some attention. It had shrunk to half an hour, and only saw release when paired with a Circus Bear cartoon, Fun and Fancy Free. Walt loved the story, but Mickey got upstaged in his own comeback vehicle. The mouse and his film were both pear-shaped. Mickey's latest flop might also have prompted Walt to walk away from the minor task of voicing Mickey Mouse. Jimmy McDonald, Disney's resident sound effect guru, took over the role. "I think he was getting too busy to really get down and do it," McDonald said. Few noticed the change. After McDonald would come a cavalcade of falsettos, including Clarence Nash, Alan Young, better known as Mr. Ed's companion, and even Stan Freberg. Staffers began to pull pranks on new hires, asking them to audition to be Mickey, then claiming the mic was picking stray noises from shoes or a belt buckle or a shirt collar. Only when the auditioners were half-naked in the booth were they let in on the joke. Walt refused to admit he walked away from voicing Mickey. "The kids might notice the difference if we gave the job to somebody else," he said, quite aware that they had not noticed. "Maybe Mickey isn't as popular as he was, but I want to give the kids something to hang on to." Privately, he'd sometimes grow grouchy that he wasn't voicing Mickey anymore. Even if he had the time, his middle-aged, smoke-cured pipes just couldn't squeak into a proper register anymore. Mickey's sudden disappearance from culture had trapped him in the amber pre-war days of the 1930s. Mickey Mouse was stranded in the past, a literal has-been. Because of that, though, he started looming large in the world of mind. Memories are wonky in many ways, and in this case, almost all those ways benefited Mickey. Perhaps it was his simplicity of character. All that, "Let's put on a show, Elon," is hard to recall as distinct installments. He went from movie star to memory star. That ex who becomes more impressive after the breakup. Speaking of breakups, The dawn of the post-war era meant Walt could consider ending the iWorksization of Disney Studios. The military films had been replaced with industrial films which barely paid the bills, but the work required little creativity. In the reverse of Hollywood logic, they received none of the rewards of a hit, yet all the blame for a miss. And that was if you won a contract in the first place. Walt wanted his money is no object company back at any cost. Slumming it was not enough. Returning to the feature a year days might be impossible, but he'd once again risk the company on it. How to exit industrial films, though? The same way Mickey stopped the brooms. With an axe. Boldly, Walt told Roy one day that as of that minute, they were done with them. Just like that, done. All work was to be halted, all advanced money returned. To me, it's a slow way of liquidating, Walt argued. Let's go forward, or let's sell the business. The 180-degree turn on industrial films was savage. They went from the studio's bread and butter to the dustbin. Not only do copies of many of these films no longer exist, their very names have been forgotten. Disney historians have a better handle on obscure Julius and Oswald shorts than on films made 20 years later, distributed around the globe and seen by millions. All of Ub Iwerks's accomplishments were footsteps on a beach. He was the right man for the job, but the job was now done. Like so many others of the greatest generation, his wartime work would go unheralded for the rest of his lifetime. Only after he was gone would anyone realize who held the studio together, who made the impossible happen. Disney would not merely survive. It would live. It would rise or perhaps fall on one sole merit. Entertainment. It would re-enter features both live-action and eventually animated. It couldn't save Mickey Mouse, but the House of Mouse could embody Mickey. It could jump into projects with both feet, take risks no one else would dare. With a combination of luck and timing, new technology and old standbys, it could make people feel what they felt when a mouse danced its way into their hearts. Every Disney film since has in fact been a Mickey Mouse film. He's there in spirit. After the war, Walt was asked by a reporter from the New York Times about Mickey's declining popularity. Donald Duck was the A-list star of Disney Now, and Warner Brothers' Bugs was the looniest of the Looney Tunes. Had audiences forgotten Mickey? What they forget, Walt countered, is that the mouse hasn't made a picture since the war. He was in one short released in 42. 5 years off the screen and he still rates third. Is there any star in Hollywood with a public that loyal? This was a different tune than the one Walt sang so long before, when he complained that Mickey was like a real child, demanding more and more of my spare time. That child had grown up now. In 1945, Mickey Mouse was almost 18. Playing along with the reporter, Walt pretended to speak for Mickey himself. His attitude is that of the old master who's glad to give the youngsters a hand. After all, Walt said, this is a big place, and there's room for everybody. The mouse knows we have to keep bringing new people along, new faces. It makes his job that much easier. It was pretty tough when he was carrying the whole studio. But now he's got the Duck and Pluto and the Goof and our feature program. Quite an accomplishment for a mouse. The years of press engagements had given Walt the skill of perfect gift-wrapped answers. The reporter ended his interview asking how much money Mickey had made for Disney. Walt asked for what year, which flummoxed the reporter. Collecting his marbles, he rephrased the question. What had Mickey made over his 2-decade run? Me, Walt replied. Part 6. Yen Sid, 1946 to the present. Stuart rose from the ditch, climbed into his car, and started up the road that led toward the north as he peeked ahead into the great land that stretched before him. The way seemed long, but the sky was bright, and he somehow felt he was headed in the right direction. E.B. White, Stuart Little. Chapter 38, Tomorrowland, 1946 to the present. Like a vaudeville plate spinner, Walt managed business branches in shorts, live-action features, animated features, and new forays such as nature documentaries. Despite all that activity, it was impossible to find a place for Mickey. Cartoons were the past for Walt Disney Pictures. Disney was now a live-action studio for the most part. Disney still retained some animators for a short or two, but that was to keep the crew primed for a future return to feature-length cartoons. Live-action features offered more profits for less work. "A lot of people wonder why we haven't made a feature with Mickey," Walt said. "It wasn't for lack of trying, but Mickey was a creature of the shorts. All the things that made him work in small doses were toxic to 90-minute installments. Features required people to change, to combat their flaws, to make life-altering decisions. Mickey could do none of that. He was adamantine. In order to keep the mouse alive," animator Harry Tittle recalled, "we did an awful lot of subjects, mostly Pluto's, where we would have an opening couple of scenes of Mickey, then the dog would go and do something. We'd call it a Mickey." One of Walt's straw-grasping suggestions for a Mickey feature doubled as a masterclass in how to defuse a public relations debacle. "We could use the opening business," Walt said to his story department, "where Mickey, Don, and the Goof are protesting. They're going on strike. They want to work in features. Have the drawn characters working with the human figures. Disney unfair to short subject actors." The strike was far enough away that Walt could joke about it. Note also that Walt placed Mickey on the opposite side of the strike line. He went on to describe how all three characters would bicker about who got to narrate the story, but that's where the plate stopped spinning. There was no story to tell. You'd have to retool Mickey into a character with backstory and depth, scrub off his perfect patina. There was verboten. Mickey was too valuable as a symbol to ruin with a single film. The man who met his company with Caprice was now too worried about an ancient cartoon's reputation to take a chance. Mickey Mouse would never have a film career. But film, it turns out, was thinking small. In the post-war years, Walt began to dream of a place called Mickey Mouse Land. Mickey Mouse Land would sit across the street from the studio, filling the lot where the protesters had camped out. It would be everything people hoped to see when they stopped by Walt Disney Studios before they were invariably disappointed by pale men hunched over desks. Walt imagined a train station with working tracks, vendors, a firehouse, movie theater, restaurants, art studio, and so forth. This dream would consume Walt. Over the years, he added more and more elements to his Ultima Thule. A zoo, a carnival, a park, a fair. It went from faux studio to an architectural rendering of Walt's brain. That enthusiasm would eventually change the dream park's name. This wasn't Mickey Mouse Land. The name would be, had to be, Disneyland. It would be as earnest and corny as the man himself. And as a Midwesterner, Walt loved to point out that people loved corn. Disneyland would become a storytelling engine with unlimited legroom. Everything in the history of entertainment could find a home there. It drew Walt's attention away from live-action features, which in turn had pulled him away from cartoons. It would be worthy of the Disney name, and what that name now meant. Despite not being named Mickey Mouse Land, Mickey was the most popular person there. The lines for Mickey meet and greets grew so long, one mouse couldn't do it all, and one doesn't. Dozens of simultaneous Mickeys hold court at highly scheduled times, so no two appear at the same time. Screen Mickey and Print Mickey meet Park Mickey. When the park first opened, Icecapades costumes were used. Small head worn by tall, thin men in size 30 shorts over black tights. "It is actually astonishing that Mickey held his identity," Imagineer John Hinch said. "Making him a real-life character represented a violent shift that violated the head-to-body proportion. Over the years, Mickey's head has grown larger, possibly from all the attention. The rangy men who wore them were replaced by short women. The costumes went from skin-tight to baggy. The illusion of smallness somehow held. Mickey was becoming a celestial being. Going to see Mickey at a Disney park has become a cultural pilgrimage, the culmination of a lifetime of devotion. Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, the Disney Channel, VHS tapes, and video games, every year brought a new venue, a new church in which to praise his name. Mickey worship, even with its child-safe corners, still clicks open the lock of spirituality. Disney cartoons were uniformly prescribed to the baby boom generation and forced in reruns, re-releases, picture books, and paraphernalia. Boomers, like all children, rebelled against their parents' institutions, whether it be Lawrence Welk or draft cards, but they drew the line at the secular religion of ducks, dogs, and mice. That was maintained. That was cherished. Mickey reascended at a lucky time, the 1950s. Animation was confined to television, and lower budgets mandated 12 or 8 frames per second of flat, rigid figures. This limited animation was known as animated radio. When Fred Flintstone talked, only his mouth moved. If he waved, only his arm moved. Hanna-Barbera excelled at this minimal, cheap art form. It was nicknamed Hanna and the Barbarians for its chilling effect on the art form. Animation's future was blinking out of existence one retirement at a time, a dying tribal language. It cost $100,000 to make a 7-minute cartoon, Walt said in 1961, and you can't get your money back. Like a solo artist who broke up the band, Walt moved on to other forms of entertainment. Mickey's medium was circling the drain. But life does all sorts of funny things, especially under the Disney umbrella. Everywhere one looks, one sees animals not quite properly alive. Mice walk and talk. Jungle Cruise hippos rear up on cue. A two-legged dog in a hat pets a domesticated dog on all fours. Some animals, like Bambi, are more realistic, but they're still fake. Filmed animals in the nature documentaries are made untrue thanks to editing. Even the actual animals in the park exist in a false setting. The fox bats of Disney's Animal Kingdom are not in India, but Orlando, Florida. But just as painting blank ink on a negative will produce a strip of shining white, there is another way to take in all this simulacra. Instead of the real made fake, consider it as Disney bestowing life to the inanimate. Mickey as Pinocchio, a pure heart made real because his creator so loved it, because he was a real boy. Where cynics see wacky hats and robot critters, the faithful see and celebrate the joy of creation. Creators show up more than usual in the Disney canon. There are the inventors, everyone from Geppetto to Professor Brainard to Belle and her father. There are the musicians, Mickey, of course, as well as the casts of 100 silly symphonies. There are the artists, the trendsetters, the original thinkers. Even the villains are often creators. Cruella de Vil is a fashion designer, and Sid rebuilds his toys. The creator is the part of us that never stops imagining, the part that turns a hairbrush into a microphone, an index finger into a ray gun, a pretzel stick into a cigar. Modern life can be at odds with imagination. Better to purchase an off-the-rack gray flannel suit and blend in. Most every religion has a key component that you have to agree with what people before you have decided on. You can't add that to the mythos. So who created the creative spark lurking in Disney's characters? Think of the qualities that are celebrated as Disney's. The humbled ego, the unquenchable drive to explore, the emphasis on family, the cooperativeness and lack of guile. These are the Uncle Walt's suite of character traits. But Walt's great gift was leadership, not invention. Ub Iwerks was the inventor. Leadership is routinely ignored in the Disney canon. Ub was destined to be forgotten. Not everyone accepts that fate with the grace Ub did. He accepted the dying light that Walt seemed to spend the latter half of his life raging against. Ub stopped chasing a lofty vision to focus on bettering the world around him. It takes a special person to live happily that way. Special, perhaps, but not rare. Disney was built by 1,000 such disciples, men and women willing to labor for Walt's dream at the cost of their own. It is now filled with tens of thousands of apostles, actors and imagineers and costumers and pencilers and cast members who keep that dream alive. The billion-dollar Fortune 500 company of today is a living memorial not to Walt or to Mickey, but to them. Call this group Disney if you must, But even Walt accepted that it wasn't him anymore. Those before us built pyramids and pagodas and temples that still stand. Those who work for Disney have similar assurance. In a world of felled giants, their toil will survive. Walt and Ub worked in the era of Texaco, Pan Am, and Packard. All three are distant memories now, gods no longer worshipped with the sacrifice of coin. New gods have replaced them. Luke Oil, JetBlue, Tesla. That is the way of mortal ideas. They live, they die, and from their anointed ashes come the next generation. This happens. This happens to every company, every person, every story, and every idea. No one gets out of here alive. Except for legends. Legends fly through an escape hatch into the resurrected realm of mythology. Mickey has become such a legend, avoiding the fate of his contemporaries. As such, he exists in a world of 21st century immortals, the part of our soul that hungered for stories of Gilgamesh's strength and Coyote's tricks now have Luke Cage's bulletproof skin and Jack Sparrow's double crosses. Luke and Jack, both owned by Disney. Mickey fills the role of society's innocent man, somewhere between Jean Valjean and Job. What makes Mickey unique is that one of his creators has become a legend as well. Walt Disney sits in Mount Olympus, among fellow creators Charles Dickens and Dr. Seuss, Alfred Hitchcock and Pablo Picasso. You've heard of the self-made man? All who sup at this table are self-made gods. Even legends, though, have lifespans. Modern cineasts don't know the stars of the silent era. Forgotten classics of yesteryear provide the loam that grows the new crop of art. This is the occult danger Mickey Mouse and his eternal copyright poses for our society. His cocoon of red tape makes him not so much immortal as undead. He will provide no nourishment for future generations of creators. He will poison the watershed of myth. No one of his age will be allowed to die. Mickey the God may be the start of something new, but he is also the end of a very, very old human tradition. Then again, U.S. copyright only lasts as long as the United States does. Will Mickey outlast the country where he was born? Could some unimaginable corporate Visigoths take down a Disney, sell Mickey to the highest bidder? Could a schism break out over whether Mickey should be pie-eyed? Will Mickey be remembered 1,000 years from now the way Robin Hood is? 2,000 like Hercules? 3,000 like Odysseus? The proper yardstick to measure this mouse's lifespan is geologic. Assuming Mickey survives, will he still be remembered for the mouse he is today? The prolific playwright and poet A.A. Milne is known only for the stories he made up about his child's toys. The social reformer H.G. Wells is known only for his science fiction oddities. Both are also remembered due to Disney films of their stories. What's better, to suffer oblivion or to be celebrated for an asymmetrical sliver of your life, unremembered or misremembered? Mickey has an advantage on that front. He entered the world just as our societal memory became a permanent record. Sci-fi author William Gibson called photography a time machine. For the brief window the camera allows, you can see into the past. Anytime we want, we can espy Mickey in all his tune-whistling 1928 glory. The physical medium of film and its digital upgrades ensures that Mickey will stay Mickey forever. The next time you watch a Disney film, a troika of minds will be inspiring it. One is Mickey Mouse. One is Walt Disney. One is Ub Iwerks. The heart, the head, and the hands. Three circles merge together into one American soul. Let's give Walt Disney the last word. Sometimes, Walt said, I try to figure out why Mickey Mouse appealed to the whole wide world. Everybody's tried to figure it out. As far as I know, nobody has. He's a pretty nice fellow, and he never does anybody any harm. He gets into scrapes through no fault of his own, but always manages to come up grinning. Why, Mickey's even been faithful to one girl all his life. Mickey is so simple and uncomplicated. It's so easy to understand that you can't help liking him.
This has been an Audible Studios production of A Mouse Divided, written by Jeff Ryan, performed by J.D. Jackson. Executive producers, Laura Gatchko and Mike Charzuk. Producer, Chelsea Pita. Copyright 2018 by Jeff Ryan. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.